The doctrine of reincarnation and karma developed among a people who are known to have been profound students of astrology. But we have certain points, I think, that we should clarify. In the ages when these doctrines were in the formation, there was no essential science dedicated to the study of the universe except astrology. Astronomy as we know it today did not exist. And one more recent astronomer, somewhat embarrassed over the background of his science, has stated that astronomy was the same child of a mad parent. This is one simple way of pointing out that from mistakes, great truths arise. The study of astronomy in antiquity could never have held the interest of the people had it been concerned primarily with the chemical analyses of distant stars or an effort to measure the direction of the continuum. These abstractions broke a pattern to which antiquity was consistently addicted. Whenever the ancient discovered anything, his first question was, what does it mean to me? What does it mean in my personal life? What does the enlargement of our understanding of the universe mean to us now? How can we use it to live better, to think better, and to be better? Thus, in old times, the universe was explored only that man could come to understand more clearly the laws governing his own conduct. It was assumed that man was part of the universe. Whatever rules and regulations existed in space applied to man, and he must live according to them and be obedient, for these laws represented the will of God in action, the continual motion of universal principles. This also led to a second consideration, namely that all laws and all principles in operation are not only mechanical principles or mechanical processes, they are also intelligent processes, conscious processes, laws and principles that can be and should be interpreted in terms of their moral and psychic value, and not merely as the elements of a universal machinery. Even today, the most simple machine that we invent, or the most complicated one, if we considered it philosophically, it would give us a code of morality, because these things are lawful or they will not operate. Some machines teach us cooperation. Others teach us coordination. Others reveal to us processes applicable to our own bodies, to our minds, to our souls. It is said that the early Romans, confronted with the problem of creating water supplies for great cities, patterned their system of aqueducts from a study of the arterial system of the human body. And they developed the two prongs of this, the arterial circulation and the venous circulation, creating from one their aqueducts and from the other their sewage systems. And until they had recognized this law operating in man, they could not apply it to the needs of community existence. Thus it is that older peoples, forever observant, and building their philosophies very largely upon observed phenomena, became keenly interested in observing all that they could, recognizing that in this way they could advance the social state of human society. If, therefore, we wish to take this position, I think we can say that astrology, to them, was a kind of moral astronomy. It was the psychology of the heavens rather than its physiology. It was the spiritual meaning of the sidereal complex rather than a mere attempt to penetrate the anatomy of space. Out of this moral meaningfulness, there evolved a number of related systems of thought. At a very early time, astrology seems to have formed a strong partnership with religion, something that again rather differs from our modern viewpoint on these things. Among those nations where astrology was originally practiced were the highest religious peoples and philosophical peoples existing at the time. We know that astrology developed among the Grecians, that it was more or less brought to the Romans through the contact with Greek civilization. It developed among Oriental peoples, particularly in India and China. It also developed in North Africa, in the schools of Northern Egypt, as Alexandria, Memphis, and other great culture centers. As one has observed historically, no nation of antiquity ever reached a high degree of civilization without the development of a science of prognostics through the stars. Today we can say to ourselves, to what degree do these old beliefs survive? Are we correct in assuming that we have an adequate perspective either on the belief in astrology or on the belief in reincarnation and karma? I think our perspective is rather inadequate for the most part, although perhaps we are better equipped for a larger perspective than ever before in history. We can say to ourselves, who believes in astrology today? And if we are to read the popular journals against the subject, we may say very few people. If we read the publications published by various astrological groups, we can say quite a number of people. But to what degree does this concept actually exhaust the subject? I think to a very slight degree. There are still in the world a number of religions and systems, cultural and moral, which originally involved astrology. Most of these groups still involve it. And I think we can say with safety that about 350 million Hindus are at least sensitive to the astrological problem. They may not be working at it enthusiastically, but it is part of their way of life. We know, for example, that Mohandas Gandhi had his horoscope calculated when a baby, that he kept this document with him, and that in a strange way it was remarkably accurate, dating nearly all of the important incidents of his life. We also know that only very recently, in a death and replacement of a ruler in the Indo-Chinese area, that the coronation of the King of Laos was postponed for nearly a year because the planetary aspects were not propitious. These things are still happening in many parts of the world. Another vast area that is sensitive to astrology, as in the case of the King of Laos, is the Buddhist world. And while it cannot be said that all Buddhists are enthusiastic in this department, it is again part of the tradition that has been handed down to them. And it does affect the governments and the administrations of nearly 40 Buddhist nations today. So perhaps we have an area, including these and other smaller groups, of persons essentially sensitive to astrology that would probably number in the neighborhood of 1 billion human beings. Now, on the problem of rebirth or reincarnation and karma, we are working contemporaneously with about the same pattern, although I think we may say that this belief is held more generally and more solidly than the belief in astrology. So I think it is safe to say today that in the neighborhood of 1 billion to 1.25 billion human beings now living accept the doctrine of rebirth and karma as a natural religious philosophy. This is, of course, largely true outside of the areas of our immediate experience, as most people are not keenly aware of the functions of foreign powers. I think we may also point out that down through history, both these doctrines, astrology and reincarnation, have been held together among some of the most brilliant peoples in the world's recording. Apparently, reincarnation was brought to the attention of the Greek scholars as the result of their travels in the Far East. Among the pioneers in this, of course, was Pythagoras of Samos, who in about the 6th century B.C. seems to have brought this doctrine, the doctrine of reincarnation, strongly to the attention of the Greeks. Its greatest exponent in Greece, of course, was Plato. And the entire descent of the Platonic and Neoplatonic schools was in harmony or in line with this general belief. Reincarnation and karma reached Rome as a result of Greek teachers setting up their academies in the capital of the Roman Empire. It also penetrated into Byzantium and into the great Eastern Empire of Rome. Thus, we have a doctrine of great historical interest and one which perhaps could help us in solving some of our more pressing, immediate difficulties. We, I think, are entitled to regard this matter in a rather more sympathetic way than it has generally been handled. Not long ago, I knew a gentleman who was doing his doctoral thesis in religion in one of our largest universities. He asked his committee to permit him to do his thesis on reincarnation. I think the committee was a little flabbergasted at the prospect, but having had a quiet session among themselves, the committee men reported favorably on the project. As educators, as leaders in a great university, they said the subject was entirely proper, inasmuch as any subject is proper, which has held the esteem of the learned and the thoughtful for thousands of years and has had as large an influence on society as this one. The main problem was that such a thesis must be handled in a manner fitting to a doctorate degree. It must be carefully thought out, it must be adequately documented, and must indicate the research and thoughtfulness of the person preparing the thesis. The thesis was prepared, it was of the quality necessary, and the doctorate was awarded. So you can handle these subjects, even in our unbelieving world, if you want to handle them adequately. And I think that brings us to our problem today, namely that believers in these things should not develop an inferiority complex on the grounds that they are isolated sufferers against a cruel world. Actually, nearly half the population of the world is on their side. And the main issue always is to find out what these doctrines really are, to differentiate between popular belief and serious belief, and to investigate the various imponderables in a manner that is satisfactory to a sure knowledge or a real thoughtfulness in the area under consideration. What would you say, or how shall we say, that the contact between astrology and the idea of reincarnation was first strengthened? I believe that astrology contributed heavily to it in its gradual unfoldment of the sense of the way the universe operated. We may have certain restrictions of view as to the validity of all astrological findings, but we do know that the priests of Chaldea and Babylon and the ancient sages of India studied the stars, studied thoughtfully and reasonably the laws and rules governing universal process. They had a great advantage in this over our way of thinking. Today, when we study, we go into a very congested classroom or a bustling library. We sit down and try to find adequate texts, and we become part of a very tight system of acceptances and rejections. It was rather different in those days. These scholars simply went out by themselves into the wilderness, sat down quietly on the side of a hill or climbed to the top of some ruined tower, and just absorbed the universe into their own consciousness. They watched, they considered. They were not interrupted. No one really told them what to think or what to discover. They simply became receptive to the larger world, trying to understand with the faculties that had been given to them. Out of this quiet, meditative acceptance of the universe came most of the foundations of knowledge as we understand knowledge today. We have yet tried to find who taught the first great teachers, and we are convinced that to a measure they were taught by space itself. They simply remained accepting beings, without dogma, without opinion, without prejudice, without intolerance. And by the very nature of their own souls, they were able to receive knowledge. They made mistakes, certainly, but they were grand mistakes, mistakes in terms, perhaps, of seeing more than there was to see. But certainly they were kindly mistakes, ever searching for better things, for greater truths, for greater beauty in the universe around them. One of the early observations of these ancient scientists, for they were scientists in their own time, one of their observations was the continuance of universal phenomena. Several of the Greeks wrote about this from their early recognitions. They suddenly found that they were in a universe in which nothing really began and nothing really ended. Instead of the concept that we have, they felt a universe of organized motion, forever flowing in great cycles. These cycles were not circles. Creatures did not come back to a starting point. They cycled up and up in a strange mystic spiral, moving apparently in circles, but actually always returning to a higher level than that from which they started. The universe was a continuing interrelationship of cycles. Ezekiel called it wheels within wheels. And the early gazers into the mystery of space found in space only one thing, and that was life. They found life everywhere. They observed that this life was constantly changing its appearances, but its substance never changed. They recognized it as combining with patterns of itself to make innumerable diversity, yet the unity of this life itself never changed. And living under a heaven that moved in incredible arcs of time, yet with the recurrence of the annual seasons, the recognition that in the springtime life came out of the earth, that life unfolded and developed and bore its fruit and its seed. And then it seems as though life died, but life did not die. And after the long, cold months of winter, life came forth again in all its grandeur at the following equinox. Thus the system of the universe told something of birth and growth, maturity and decline, of death and of resurrection, For in this mystery, our ancient forebears saw forever resurrection, the restoration of life, and all their theologies and all their doctrines. And this extended down to the most primitive of peoples, recognized this mystery of life coming forth, of life restored and resurrected from the mystery of death. And those especially who inhabited what we call temperate zones were particularly aware of the continual program or procession of life moving on through space. It became very difficult for these ancient peoples to take death seriously. They recognized naturally that forms die, but they recognized also that trees seem to die in winter. They realized that the human body could not be preserved as the tree was, although in some areas they tried their best to preserve the body through mummification and other religious rituals. But most of all, they came to the conviction that life was a reality, and that anything that seemed to deny that reality was itself some way false or misunderstood. Thus, the doctrine of the immortality of the human soul was certainly largely sustained and supported by the study of the universe. And most of all, not only was this immortality recognized, but that it was a lawful, reasonable immortality was also strongly believed. The ancients could not conceive of anything living for no purpose. They could not accept the idea that the life of the human being was an isolated experience. They could not assume that everything in nature was unfolding according to law, and man was a strange little separate creature that accomplished very little and hastened himself and his neighbors to an early grave. They did not admit that this could be true. They recognized, therefore, that in some way the life of man was important, that it was part of nature, that in man moved the same forces that moved the stars, that in man the same laws were unfolding that maintained the universe, and therefore that man had to be just as important as any other unit in the great universal system. This unit had to also have its own immortality because nothing really died. And out of all of these considerations came the final conclusion that man as a being had a destiny with the destiny of all things, that he did not have a separate little destiny. Man was not created by a peculiar, separate procedure. He was not simply given domain over nature. He was nature. Nature existed in him. But he was given certain faculties and powers, not generally observable in other creatures. And by these very faculties and powers, he was given a certain leadership, and was given the privilege, the opportunity, or the responsibility to cooperate in the natural processes of things. Man was the only creature that the ancient knew capable of cooperating consciously and intelligently with the purpose of universal destiny. This attitude led naturally to the enlargement of philosophy and religion, morality and ethics. It led the ancients to create codes for the peculiar use of man, defining his powers and also affirming his responsibilities and his duties in nature. Now, it was a common observation, of course, that all creatures were born into a kind of nature. We're born into a world that was governed by the peculiar laws which we call natural law, as contrasted rather improperly with divine law. For our most ancient forebears believed there was only one kind of law, and that this law was manifested through two expressions, one being the laws of spirit and the other the laws of matter. But they were one great pattern operating on two levels of function. It was observed by these older peoples also that if men planted according to the seasons, their harvests flourished. But if they planted out of season, the plants did not grow properly. Therefore, there was a time for all these things to happen, and that according to the timing of things, their destinies were unfolded. It was further observed by these people that in nature, particularly the plants and animals, mating was according to season, or that growth was according to season, or pollinization, or the casting of seed from plants was according to season. But in man, fertility was continuous. But this does not mean that there are not certain seasons that produce their own harvests. It was therefore only a step to assume that man was a highly diversified being, and that therefore many kinds of seasons existed for him, and that he was born in one period of the year, his destiny could unfold in one way, that if he was born in another period, that he came under a different group of seasonal processes. Yet man was capable of maturing and fulfilling his destiny when born under any season. Thus seasons became not problems of life and death, but of directive, of the direction in which things move, and how rapidly this motion can be accomplished. Naturally, our forebears were much concerned with the mystery of birth. To them, a life coming into the world was subject not merely to our biological considerations, but to things seen and observed by an empiric process. One thing that the Chinese noted at an early date, and so did other people, was a physical phenomenon of rather amusing, but perhaps intriguing, import. Most small children, most newborn babes, have about them a strange and abstract look of age. There is nothing that looks much older than a brand new baby. It enters this world with the most quizzical and difficult expression. Although its features are yet ill-shapen, it has something about it of a meditating sage, of an ancient grandparent. It looks upon life with the pessimism of great years, even at the beginning, and expresses this pessimism usually by entering into this world in a fit of tears and howling. Also, one of the first things that happens to it when it gets here is to be spanked. In other words, it is only by punishment it seems to be able to live. All these things meant something to our remote ancestors. They were very observing. To them, all of these were symbols of some real process in nature. It was also soon observed that the small child coming into the world manifests, as it begins to coordinate, a kind of unworldly wisdom. Children are not just as ignorant and helpless as we would like to think they are. Physically, they have very little to support them, and they are born less fortunately than the average animal. But in terms of culture and in terms of innate life, the ancients observed that children had a grasp of things, a grasp of value. And long before they were old enough to reason for themselves, they were able to ask questions that their elders could not answer. Thus it seems that the small child is born into this world with a natural inquiry, a desire to know, and that gradually, by the various processes of our way of life, this natural hunger for learning is not fulfilled, but stones are substituted for food. And by degrees, this natural inquiry is blunted until the person, having reached the age of reason, begins to live unreasonably. This is the way in which we seek to solve this problem. It was inconceivable to the ancient peoples that this life in man, by which he was a living thing, was actually conferred by birth. It seemed to the ancient more definitely that this child, this little one, was more than a mere physical thing. That if it was simply physical, it would remain so. But somewhere in this newborn babe was locked the mystery of a Plato or an Aristotle or a Leonardo da Vinci or a Raphael or a Michelangelo. Something within this being, although the creature itself was small and of slight concern, yet there was within it something that could change the world. No one could know what was locked in the soul of this newborn babe, whether it be a genius or a tyrant, whether it be great or mediocre. Only time, situations, and conditions could reveal. So the older peoples held this constant state of observing inquiry, of trying to understand the kind of creature that was coming to be part of their lives and homes. This led to further consideration of where this child could have been prior to its arrival here. Was it new? Was it something that had never existed before? Was it simply a product of the generative processes of its parents? Why did it come where it came? Why did one child come among the patricians and another among the commoners? Why was one born into the races that were dominant and another born into races that were subservient? There seemed to be no explanation for this, and yet it worked a strange and mysterious hardship upon the child. For if it was an unfortunate birth, this child was very heavily conditioned against success or against the maturity of its potentials. These things led to an effort to rationalize, to find some reason why a child was born into a peculiar destiny, why it was born into this world at all. Why, if it was born, it could not have been created by a creative fiat, the mere speaking of a word. Why this creature had to pass through all these periods of growth and development, in which it was a burden to others and itself. Why it would later fall into decrepitude. These problems caused the individual to attempt to restore in his own thinking the divine plan operating in nature. Our older philosophers and scholars realized that this plan itself had to be right, that whatever system of reasoning they used had to sustain the facts, and also had to give to these facts overtones that were great enough to make life significant. Materialism would have been utterly inconceivable to these people, because it was sterile, because it solved nothing, because it gave nothing to strengthen or unfold or develop the character or the integrity of the individual. To meet this problem, then, there were only two or three possible answers. Either the child had to be a newborn babe, coming into this world out of nothing by some strange and mysterious act of providence, or it could possibly be regarded as merely the projection of its ancestors, the continuing of a life thread from generation to generation, this thread conditioned always by that which had gone before. By this means, or by this concept, the sins of the fathers descended unto the children unto the third and fourth generation. This was perhaps a neat bit of figuring, but it was a little hard on the children, because it suddenly caused the individual's personal character to be victim to his forebears, and he was predestined and foreordained by a destiny over which he had no control to be slightly dishonest because one of his ancestors had been a celebrated buccaneer. This did not answer too much or give too much reality to the problems of living. The only other answer seemed to be that the individual was here because of something that he himself had done. Now, this was a rather complicated situation, and it also annoyed the Pharisees quite a bit during the period of the life of Jesus. And therefore, Jesus is questioned as to whether or not it was this man's sins or his father's sins that caused him to be born blind. Now, had there not been some question in the popular mind of the day, how would it have been framed that a man's own sins could have caused him to be born blind? The Pharisees, of course, generally held reincarnation. Therefore, their question evidently was pointed in this direction. Namely, that there was a possible explanation that the individual was fulfilling himself, that he was not a blind product of blind destiny, but an unfolding creature by whose very nature this unfoldment had to extend over a longer period of time than the opportunities of any one life could provide. Now, this is interesting because the Greeks and the Chaldeans were working on it. For example, we have something we study today called history. Now, history is the unfoldment of the activities of human beings over long periods of time. It is a record of the growth of races and of nations and of systems and of the rise of individuals of prominence. Yet most persons living today can only read history of any time except their own. Some people would kind of wish they could have been born perhaps in the golden age of Greece, where they could have studied with Pythagoras or Plato and Aristotle. Others would like to be born 1,000 years from now, when they hope we will have more common sense than we have today and that our affairs will go better. One of the most common things to observe is that the individual is not quite certain that he was born in the most fortunate period. This has been common to all periods, and every generation has questioned the delight of belonging to a larger historical cycle. But if there is any importance in history, if the experience of the race from the beginning is meaningful, what does this mean? It means that humanity is moving through a vast cycle of time. There have been some recent revisions by anthropologists as to the probable age of the human being in nature. Not long ago, it was a comparatively short cycle. Today, anthropology has decided that man has been here as man not less than 1 million years, perhaps longer. It'll probably be 5 or 10 million years one of these days. We are pushing this boundary back. In any event, man is here for a long experience, and history is the unfolding of our reaction to every kind of stimuli. It is the story of the growth of our governments, the growth of our arts and sciences, the growth of our cultures, the unfoldment of our religions, and the gradual enrichment of our arts and crafts. All of these things are continually unfolding and will do so into the future. And in the midst of this, at any moment, we place man as an individual with 70 or 80 years of expectancy if he keeps off the freeways. This situation seems to mean that the individual at any one time is framed by past and present, and like an unrolling scroll, only a little part of which is seen at a time, his own life is rounded by an unconsciousness. He has no distinct relation to the past except in terms of a book he can read. He has no relation to the future except in the thought that perhaps his descendants will be better than he is. Yet how is this going to contribute to the perfection of the human being now? The only answer is that man is not going to be perfect now, according to this concept, that the human being is going to live and die as a tiny segment in a process of universal motion. What does this accomplish? Supposing there is some place in space where those who have accomplished in various ages rest on their levels of accomplishment, where somewhere in the background was a highly benevolent, very kindly, well-disposed old witch doctor. He had lived perhaps long before the age of reason as we know it, and the best he could do was rattle a few bones and say a few prayers or magical incantations over the sick of his tribe. But still he was well-loved and well-honored in his day. There he is. Thousands of years have passed, but he is gone. And if he is resting anywhere in space, he is still what he was. There seems to be no way of changing this. He would have a little difficulty in communicating adequately with a scholar from the golden age of Pericles. He would be a man with great erudition, great understanding, great sympathy, but with perhaps a rather limited perspective on the things that modern people consider to be essential. He would be on his level. He could scarcely really fraternize pleasantly with the witch doctor, who would not understand him, even though he might understand the witch doctor. Then there would be modern man with his arts, his sciences, his machines, his projectiles into space, his innumerable gadgets and commodities, his modern attitudes on everything. He would seem to be the apex of something, at the moment the apex of emergency, but we hope to get by. But 10,000 years from now, where will he be? He will simply be part of the experimental dust of the past. Others will build upon whatever contributions he left and hope to correct whatever mistakes he made. But he is gone. Thus, man himself, in this great process, observes the total unfoldment of his species. He sees his own kind moving triumphantly from one experience to another, but actually he can never share in it. He can only share in a little thing called now. And then he is gone. And in his going, he loses all contact with what appears to be the purpose of existence. And that is the unfoldment of man. Humanity unfolds, man dies. This is one of the scientific adages of our time. The collective gradually enriches, but the individual forming the collective may perish as impoverished as he was born. Such did not please ancient thinking. He said it just won't work. If that's the way it is, we might as well all lie down now and end the process. Actually, there has to be some way in which the individual life moves with the great motion of existence. And to meet this, the ancients created the doctrine of rebirth, so that the individual, even though today he has no memory of the past, yet he was the past. This great story of history is his story, the story of an unfolding consciousness moving through the infinities of time, that man himself passes through this whole great pattern. And the duration of humanity, whether it be 1 million years or 10 million years or 1,000 million years, this duration of humanity is also the duration of the individual. That he himself is part of a great wave of life. That this life wave is forever moving. And that he moves with it. Sometimes he moves with it visibly. Sometimes he moves with it invisibly. Sometimes he belongs to that part of the wave of life which is embodied. Sometimes he belongs to that part which is not embodied. But we know there is an unembodied part because it is forever producing bodies. Therefore, man belongs either to the production or to the power which causes production. He is either among those things now manifested, or he sleeps waiting manifestation in that power which manifests all things. This seemed to make a good common sense pattern to individuals who had the peculiar sense of honesty. Honesty has something to do with the rights of things, the rights of life, the privileges, opportunities, and duties of life. It does not seem entirely proper to these older peoples that man should ever experience what he does not deserve. They had no concept in those days of man being forgiven everything and allowed to do as he pleases. The ancient realized that man could make mistakes, that he would make mistakes. But they also came to the conclusion that mistakes are not as big as life. That life and history record infinite varieties of mistakes, but life goes on. Some men make great wars, but life goes on.